Okay, so welcome everybody. I'm going to go ahead and get started here. I'm Nathan Wallach. I am the professor of music technology at Stetson University, and I'm also the director of the digital arts program at Stetson University. I'll talk a little bit more about that in my actual presentation as far as where that comes from, but today I'm going to be talking to you a little bit about sound design and what sound design is, how you might want to get started in sound design, some things, some options you have available to you, resources that are out there, books you might want to start looking at if you're considering kind of studying up on the topic and doing a project with your students. And so I guess some of the questions that we've already started answering with a few folks here is, who is this presentation for? Really, I've started this with the assumption that you're at a school that has some existing technology, and you're maybe looking for other project ideas, things that you can do to kind of broaden the scope of what you do with technology, things that you might not have considered, but also some projects that you might be able to use to attract non-musicians into your classroom. Sound design is a good way to get involved with that, and I'll talk a little bit about my experience at the collegiate level of working with, working with students who are musicians, students who are non-musicians, and really working on what I consider to be musical skills through the use of sound design. The obvious question is, if you read the little blurb, you might have got a little bit of a taste of it, and you might have some idea of what sound design is. And I'm actually going to, let's see here, let me see if I can do this real quick, because I can't see my next slide, and that's important. Turn off mirroring, so I can see where I'm going at it each time. There you go, good. What is sound design? Okay. Well, sound design is really the process of working on the audio portion of audiovisual projects, whether they be video, whether they be film. And so you may be familiar with some images like what I have up here in my little collage here of these boom operators on set, these people that are recording things, recording the dialogue on set, people that are out kind of capturing sounds in the environment, but also these images of these sound mixing stages with big banks of faders and mixers and mixing lots of sound to picture and people in a room talking. You may have heard about sound design and that type of things and may not have had a name for it, basically. But we all recognize when we go to the movies, right, that it's a true audio-visual experience. It's not just visual. We tend to emphasize the visual, but the audio is just as important, is just as valid, and requires quite a number of people, professionals, to make that end of the movie happen, basically. And that's where sound design comes in. Really, in film production, there's three phases of sound. Wow, okay, can we pull that door shut? Thanks. There's three phases of sound in film production, okay? The first one being the production recorders. The production recorders is that boom operator, usually, the person that you see on set, if you've seen kind of behind the scenes making of kind of movies, capturing the sound that's going on set. Then once they go into post-production, after they've done the filming with the actors, there's usually the sound editor. They're in charge of adding layers, EQing things, tweaking things, and kind of working on adding in extra layers. But then there's the sound mixer that comes behind after the music has also been into the picture, and coming up with a final balance between all of the various sound layers. And actually, if you've ever seen the Academy Awards and you didn't fast forward through those technical categories, you may have seen that there's an Oscar usually given away for best sound effects editing, and there's an Oscar usually given away for best mixing, basically. And that's usually what they're recognizing are those two categories there at the end, okay? When someone is credited on a project as a sound designer, usually they're involved in all three phases. And in fact, they're possibly even involved at the script stage in terms of looking at the script and the production of a film and reading through and coming up, cataloging where the sound possibilities are, what are the things that are going to require extra work that we need to get started on now, what are the things that we can capture on set, those types of things. Especially if you have, shall we say, like genre-specific things like sci-fi movies, the sound designer is very important because, you know, those worlds don't exist. Someone has to come up with the sound of the laser gun in the movie that is going to kill the aliens, that sort of thing, right? Okay, someone has to come up with that sound and imagine what that sounds like and do it in a way that's believable that people buy into it, okay? The question, obviously, then is we're at a music conference, right? And this is sound, which is related to music, but it's not exactly music, so why would we want to teach sound design? And in doing some research myself, looking at the MENC standards, okay, the idea of listening to, analyzing, and describing music, if we, for me, being a 20th century composer, technologist type, I have a pretty broad definition of music, you know. And if we accept that broad definition of going back to Varese and organized sound, that kind of idea, sound design really in itself requires a lot of musical thinking, musical skills. It's listening to sounds and organizing them in a way that produces a cohesive outcome, okay? Much like music, there's a lot of musical skills that go into it. And most of the people that are in this field themselves have some musical experience. Whether they came up through musical training and have, you know, bachelor's and master's degrees in music, or whether they're coming at it from a film production side of things and just happen to be someone who was kind of interested in music, and so they got stuck with this end of the sound production. There's a lot of people with that kind of story that I'll talk about a little bit as well. But this idea of listening to, analyzing, and describing music, there's vocabulary that you will build up through working with sound design that can be useful in the regular music classroom. Things like describing things as rhythmic or arrhythmic, things as tonal or noisy. Okay, there's a lot of aural training that I think comes to the fore in sound design and sound production that we don't necessarily emphasize in if those of you that took ear training classes in college, right? The main emphasis in those classes is pitch, rhythm, you know, and harmony, right? Okay. But things like timbre, I don't know, did anybody have a timbre component to their ear training class in college? No? That definitely comes to the fore in sound design. So there's other elements of music, and we all accept that timbre is part of music, and yet it's not part of I guess the DNA of how we teach listening and analyzing music, right? A lot of this stuff carries over to music as well, and also especially when you're talking about 20th century forms of music and electronic music, which is where my specialty is. Looking at standard number 8, understanding the relationship between music and other arts. It's by nature sound design. You're working in a film project where you have an interdisciplinary effect. You have actors on set. You have filmmakers who, with their cameras, it's naturally seated between disciplines. So it's a natural way to kind of hook into this call for interdisciplinarity between the arts. And it's a potential for those of you that are teaching music at a school where there maybe is a media program, which I know these are popping up in different counties, right? These media magnet schools. We have one in Seminole County, and there's some in Orange County as well, which are closer to where I am. I'm in Volusia County, but I know around the state, people are having these kind of media production magnet schools pop up. The one in Volusia just popped up in Orange City. They're doing some stuff with TV production. This is maybe a chance for you to build some bridges. Would you rather someone who has an ear and some training actually listening critically to things be in charge of the soundtrack for these films, or would you rather it just be someone who got stuck with that detail, who really would rather be behind the camera but instead got stuck behind the microphone, that sort of thing? So your skills are as critical listeners are valid and valuable in those types of productions. And getting back to my kind of broad definition of music, you know, composing and arranging music, there's a lot in 20th century music, and some people, I've seen some people, you know, try to do, maybe you remember you did that 1 week of musique concrète and music history, and maybe I want to teach something about 20th century styles, and so I'll try to do a musique concrète kind of project where they're taking sounds and organizing them. This is really almost exactly the same techniques as musique concrète, except that there's a video that goes along with it and that you're trying to synchronize with, so that if anything it provides maybe a little bit more of a hook for the students. It's not as much of a stretch as jumping right whole hog into musique concrète techniques, but the skills that you need are exactly the same. Okay, so why did I start teaching sound design? Because my PhD is in music technology, and I'm hired at a school of music, and I'm supposed to be teaching music. Why am I teaching sound design? Well, one, I did have some coursework as a graduate student in sound design. I took some classes over in the radio. I did my PhD at Northwestern University. I took some classes over in the radio, television, film department with some sound designers and working on that end of the project. But for me, where the need to stretch into sound design versus music came from is the fact that I teach in this interdisciplinary program, which I was talking to some of you about before I started the formal presentation. The digital arts program at Stetson University incorporates visual arts, music, and computer science. And all of those students, no matter what their specialty coming in, take the same 101 class where we're supposed to teach them kind of basic skills in these different areas. And for years, I was trying to teach music techniques and electronic music techniques, and these walls immediately went up. The students that are visual artists, the students that are computer science, is like, you know, I'm willing to try different things, but music, gosh, you know, I tried music back in fourth grade with recorder, and it was a disaster, that sort of thing. Okay, these walls go up when people consider themselves to be specialists in another area, students, you know, they consider themselves to be artists in other areas and good at other things, but you say music to them and they put these walls up like, I can't do that. Sound design is something that it's a little bit easier to kind of tease out of them these skills, to get to the conversation of listening critically and describing sound, putting descriptors to what they're hearing, which is a skill that is you know, sorely lacking in our society, right? We have lots of different ways of describing things, and there's a visual kind of bias to the way we talk about things. But, you know, building up our sound vocabulary and actually getting students to work with sound, it was a lot easier for me to when I was talking about sound design than when I was talking about music. And if anything, it helped level the playing field a little bit. The students that were in music didn't feel so smug and self-confident coming into the projects, basically, that, hey, I've been playing, you know, bassoon since sixth grade, so I know this. I got this music thing down. I'm good. When you start throwing sound design at them, it's usually something new for everybody. And so the musicians and the artists and the computer science or whatever background it is that you're trying to talk to people from in this interdisciplinary context, they're kind of coming at it from a fresh angle. And I've got pictures. These are pictures from Stetson. The one before are some pictures that I found on Flickr that are all licensed under Creative Commons. I'll talk about that in a minute. But these are actual images from Stetson. So, I mean, you're looking at students that are music students from up in the upper corner to this group of four students here. You've got an art student, a music student, and another art visual art student. We've got some computer science students down here. We've got John down here in the lower right-hand corner who's a videographer, a videotype student. And teaching all of them something about how to listen critically through sound design was a good way to tackle it. Okay. So what sort of technology do I need? Okay, that's the obvious question, right, coming into it, because I know it's very practical, right? You have to have your hands on the technology. You need to have the tools in order to do this type of thing. And the good news is that if you have a recent digital audio workstation in your setup, okay, you probably have the ability to run video in parallel with your music. I know we were just having some conversation about different... did I phrase that right? Probably have the ability to run video, right? GarageBand, the free music production software that comes with every Macintosh, it can run video in parallel with your audio. Okay, now you have to get past some of the it's all of the language in the software is actually built around music, so it has this thing like real instruments and I forget what the other category is, software instruments. I hate that dichotomy because you know real. On the acoustic, it should be acoustic and software, not real, because the opposite of real is unreal, and so you're, anyway, there's a little bit of a bias there, I think, if we can get that message back to Apple headquarters, you know, anyway. The idea of, you have to get past that, and if you use the real instrument tracks, you can very easily throw sound effects on there, and you can have as many of those tracks as you need to add in background layers, to add in foreground layers, speech, music, that sort of stuff, and work on layers. Work on it in layers. So, and it's as easy as just clicking and dragging the video onto your project, and it will add a video track for you into your GarageBand project. Okay, so if you're using GarageBand, you're all set to do some stuff with video. Okay, there are other things where you need to look into the support for video, and I think Pro Tools had some lower end products that didn't support video. They've in this latest go around, I believe most of them support. One track of video, which is all you really need, okay? So, again, most modern digital audio workstations are going to have support for a video track, which is what you need. You need to be able to watch your video and add sounds to it, add sounds to the other tracks, the other layers, okay? So that being said, it'd be a good idea to get your hands on one of these handheld recorders. If you've been around to any of the floor, the convention floor, a lot of people are buying these to record their bands, their ensembles, and those sorts of things. But they're great for going out into the world and capturing sounds, gathering sounds. And they're getting cheaper and cheaper. This one right here, the Zoom from M-Audio I forget what the manufacturer is. I might be wrong on the manufacturer, but it runs about $150. which is not a bad. It records right to an SD card like your digital camera does, and then you just take the. You, it has a, either a USB port on the side. You plug it in, and you just look at it. You can see all the files. You just drag and drop all the sound files over. Or you can take that SD card. If you have a card reader, you can just pop it in and pull files off that way. So it, rather than having tape or something that you have to spool, it just basically, when you hit stop, it stops recording to a file. And you hit record again, it'll open a new file, basically. And when you look at the file structure, it's just a string of files, basically. Some alternates to that, there's actually, if you have an iPhone or the newest iTouches that have microphones on them, there's an app called Recorder. It has a nice, innocuous, bland name, Recorder, okay? It's 99 cents. It records through the microphone on your iPhone or your iPod Touch, and it will record up to CD quality, okay? And the reason I recommend this over the included memo recording feature, the memo recording feature doesn't record at CD quality. It does do the compression on it. This one, you can actually, you just have to go into settings, change it over to CD quality, and you can record CD quality mono recordings right with your iPhone, okay, for 99 cents. Well, 99 cents plus the cost of the phone, but, you know, if you've got the phone in your pocket and you want to go around and do some quick recordings, grabbing things like memos, you can email the recordings to yourself once you're done. It also has a feature where you just, this Wi-Fi sync, it'll pop up with a little number that you type into your web browser, and you'll be able to see all of, if you're on the same Wi-Fi network as your iPhone, and you can see all your files, and you can just drag and drop them over. It's really easy and intuitive, okay? So that's one option for, I imagine these things are popping up not just in your pockets, but your students' pockets. Getting them involved in going out and recording and capturing sounds, more and more it's less about what recorders I have available to check out to my students and what things can I push to the platforms they already have in their pockets, okay, like the iPhones and iPod Touches. These are some of the ones that we use for checkout, and the 160 Zoom recorders, they're good, but they're not maybe as rugged as these Marantz recorders. If you need something rugged because you're worried about students beating it up, I'd start looking at the Marantz recorders and the more high-end stuff. These Marantz recorders, again, still record to those digital cards, but they have included a stereo microphone on either one. There's two different models. One is an older model, the 660, which is the one on the left. The 661 is the newer model on the right. But they're a lot more rugged. They're in the $500 to $600 range, so you're going to spend a little bit more. But for the fact that, I mean, we've had the 660s for about 3 or 4 years now, and we've flown on trips across the country and had them in baggage and dropped them and all those sorts of things, and they're worked just as fine as the day we bought them. Okay, so they're a lot more rugged than the Zoom recorders, which I know is a concern in K-12 education because students like to beat things up. It happens at college level too, I will tell you that, okay? Going out and recording things, if you're going out and capturing sounds, it's a good idea. You want to get strong levels, you want to keep, you don't want to put the recording gain too low, you want to make sure it's set, that you're not hitting clipping. Usually they'll have a level indicator, and if it's peaking out at the red end, that's too high, you want to turn it down a little bit, but you also don't want it to be too low. You want to listen while you're recording, and that's one thing you need to teach your students when you're going out and doing location recording. You'll solve so many problems if you just have headphones on, listening to what the microphone is picking up at the same time that you're actually recording it. I have students that don't do that, and they come back and they go hit play, and it's just silence because they weren't listening because they had something wrong in the settings, and it wasn't actually recording when they thought it was. And you'll solve that problem, okay? Eliminating background noises. If you're out recording, sounds in the field. I mean, everybody's maybe done this exercise of reenacting 4 minutes and 33 seconds by John Cage, right? Did you hear all the ambient noise in this room? If I stop talking for a minute, the microphone picks all that stuff up. Okay, so whenever possible, you want to turn things off, like fans, like refrigerators, like clocks ticking in the background. If that's not what you're interested in recording, you want to turn that stuff off. And it's also a good idea to record multiple takes because it's easier to edit down once you get back to the computer than other things, okay? So that kind of location recording, going out and capturing sounds, that's maybe a new piece of the puzzle for those of you that have kind of technology set up. You can do a lot of recording in your current setup. If you've got microphones set up to do recording of voice and instruments and that sort of stuff, there's no reason the students can't bring in materials to record. Sounds, things that they'd be interested in hearing what they sound like, and building up a sound library. That's one of the things that I do with my students is, we have kind of a class sound library that we all build up where everybody brings in different things One of their early assignments is actually just, you know, like, okay, you need to go pick up water sounds. You need to go get machine sounds. You need to go get, I don't know, plant sounds, that sort of stuff. And they go out, and they're responsible for getting those things, or they're responsible for bringing in things like that. And you build up a kind of a class sound library that everybody can use, okay? But where else can you get materials? Because even just going out and getting your own sounds and recording your own sounds, as good an activity as that, and as much as that in itself will be, I think, be careful what I say here. Let's say it's that process of recording sounds will build up critical listening skills. Because the student that has to pay attention to those background sounds and eliminate them in the recording process will get more in tune with listening to fine details and an overall soundscape, those types of things, okay? So I firmly believe in that. In addition to recording your own sounds and generating your own materials, whether that be video and those types of things, there's a lot of materials you can get online. And if you haven't heard of Creative Commons, anybody never heard of a Creative Commons? Okay. Creative Commons is kind of an alternative licensing scheme, okay? I don't have this video loaded, but if you do a Google search for Creative Commons, a shared culture, they have a little 3-minute and 20-second promo video explaining what Creative Commons is and why it's important and why you should believe in it. But effectively, what it does, it's a way for content creators to tag their content and say, it's okay with me if you use this, okay? The default under U.S. copyright law is all rights reserved, right? You've seen that tag on different things, right? And it means, if it says all rights reserved, officially it means you can't use this unless you have written permission, okay? Now, there is obviously, you've probably heard of fair use and those types of things, but Creative Commons is a way for people to tag their content and say, it's okay with me if you reuse this, okay? So things that have been tagged as Creative Commons, basically the only stipulation of Creative Commons is that you must give the author credit. Okay. Some of them have extra stipulations like non-commercial, which if you're all in education, congratulations, you're non-commercial. Okay, so you can use all that non-commercial content. Some of it says, some of it is whether you can use derivative products, whether you have to use the actual content as is. Ooh. Straighten that out for me. Sorry. Whether you actually need to use that as is, or whether you can actually incorporate it into another multimedia product, or whether it's okay to crop that image and that sort of stuff. But the majority of it is licensed under what's called attribution non-commercial, which means give me credit for my work and don't use it to make money off of my work, basically. Which, as long as you abide by those two stipulations and give the author credit, you're free to use this stuff. Good places to get Creative Commons materials. There's a website called archive.org, which has a lot of silent videos. Videos from the silent era where the copyright has lapsed, or archives of film projects that have been licensed generously by the original, the curators of these archives under Creative Commons, where you can use them. So I usually pick a topic, basically. There's a lot of footage from the 1939 New York's World Fair. I don't know why, but there's one of these collections that got put on there, basically. So I usually give that as the theme for my students. That you need to go on there, and it's all silent footage. So there's no sound there. There's nothing to bias them as far as what they need to put in there to begin with. So that's another good thing. But I would advise you go on ahead of time and maybe find some videos, find some things that you might want to use. And you want to look on the left-hand side. There'll be a little indication as far as what the licensing is. If it says copyright, obviously it's copyright, all rights reserved. You know, it's there for you to view. Okay. But if it says Creative Commons attribution, non-commercial, you're good to use it. Some of them even say public domain, which means that the copyright is lapsed and it's in the public domain and you can use it for anything, basically. So it's a good source. If you're not comfortable or you don't have someone to produce videos for you and you want to go grab videos to have students work on sound design projects, or even, you know, scoring music for videos, that sort of stuff is a good resource for that. I guess the other good thing about archive.org, you can preview the video right in the browser, much like YouTube, okay? Or you can then download high-quality versions. So you can preview it right there in the browser and say, yeah, I really like that. I'm going to download the full-res 2-gigabyte project if you want to have the high-res DVD project that you put together with your students later, okay? Sound clips, similar sites for sound clips. There's a site called freesound.org. This one might be a little tricky to use in class with your students because it does actually ask you to register before you start downloading things. But once you download, most of the stuff that's been contributed by people is their license under CC. I mean, my students have found stuff, you know, they need sound of a crowded market, and they type in Crowded Market, and up pops like five different recordings of crowded markets, some from around the world, basically, so they can find those different sounds that they need. You know, some of it might mean pulling together those resources for your students ahead of time and just having them ready and available, rather than them. I realize that I'm not naive. The public schools have these filters in place for different websites that they don't allow you to go to. It might mean going and finding these resources ahead of time for your students. But once you have them, you're ready to go. You're ready to start sharing them. As well, music. There's a site called CC Mixter. There, you usually don't get. You do get some finished projects, by which I mean they're kind of all fleshed out with all the musical parts there, but you also sometimes get, CC Mixter is supposed to be a site for musicians to collaborate on music projects, so you might get just a bass line from a piece that someone recorded in Brazil, okay? And you might get a conga part that someone recorded in Africa, okay? And you can kind of pull those projects. It's kind of like a big sample library that everybody can contribute to, okay, much like the sound clips, the free sound website and the video archive.org website. And archive.org does have some sounds on it as well, okay. There's some collection of old audio cylinders that people have digitized and placed on there in the public domain or licensed under Creative Commons that you can use those as well. Yeah?
Nathan, have you used
Aviary? I'm not familiar with that, no. Okay.
Freeware, and it's in the beta, but they have they're all digital. There's visual, but there's also an audio editor that you can do online. And when I didn't have my lab up and running, that's what I did. And the kids were able to do even little music kind of prep stuff by going out and taking off and doing it with a handheld recorder. But that's there, and then there's also SoundCloud, which also has.
SoundCloud has all that stuff. Yeah.
Check it out. It's really interesting.
SoundCloud is nice, just from a social media standpoint of being able to. Comment on people's work. If you're not familiar with SoundCloud, it's a way for musicians to share their music projects with each other. But you can like tag specific moments in the piece and make a comment. So if you think about commenting on stuff, usually if you think about like a blog, right? You have to read the whole blog, and then the comments are at the end. So you have to read the whole blog post, and then you read the comments, and someone might be referring to a point back in paragraph two or whatever. SoundCloud, you see the waveform of the actual point, and you can see where people have tagged stuff at specific moments. So it's like, I really like when the bass comes in at minute three. You can actually place your comment right there at that tag, and you can see where different people have tagged different moments in the song. It's a really cool resource, basically.
And Aviary is, I guess, I've never heard of the Creative Commons software, whereas it's open to everybody. So you publish it, and I can add something to it.
Yeah. That's kind of based on the Creative Commons mindset. And the Creative Commons was started by, it's a nonprofit firm out in California, a group of lawyers and content providers that started this. And it's basically, they've simplified the licensing process. Anybody could have gone to a lawyer 10, 15 years ago and said, I want to write something up so that everybody can use my content because I don't really care about this all rights reserved thing. What they've done is they've simplified the process and they've made those licenses freely available for anyone to use to help drive this kind of culture of sharing content. I'm a big believer in Creative Commons, and I talk to my students about licensing their own content under Creative Commons, just because a lot of the copyright stuff just gets in the way of innovation in the arts. Granted, it's you have to find the economic model that works for you to kind of make a living off your art on the back end of things. But there are a lot of people that are doing that. A lot of people that are licensing things under Creative Commons. And that might be another topic for another day, not to get too digressed in here, but that's good. Okay, so you're new to sound design, right? You studied a bunch of composers in college, right? You know about Bach and Beethoven and Mozart and those guys, basically. But when it comes to sound designers, because you're new at this thing, right, we want to set the bar high. We want to talk about who are the great sound designers, who are the great the greats in the film industry that have created a lot of great sound work on different films. And so names you should know, and names you should probably introduce your students to if you want to enrich the curriculum, right? I'm a big believer in not just teaching the technology and only the technology tools. Kind of enrich it with history and aesthetics and those types of things as well. So the names you should know, the names you should probably introduce your students to are Jack Foley, Jimmy McDonald, Walter Murch, Ben Burt, and Gary Rydstrom, okay? And if they're not familiar with those names, I'm sure they're familiar with some of their work, okay? So starting at the beginning, Jack Foley, okay? Jack Foley is the originator of the idea of adding in sounds during post-production. So enhancing the soundtrack more than what actually occurred on set that day with the actors, adding in sound effects, okay? So much so that there's a job that exists. You may have heard this about this job of being a Foley artist. You may have heard that terminology, okay? The Foley artist job is named after Jack Foley because he originated the job, basically. So if I can tab over here to this, there's a great little 59-second blip that the Los Angeles Times did on what a Foley artist does. I'll go ahead and play that for you and make sure it sounded okay. Oh, come on. You can do it. Oh, we have to actually play.
Foley is live sound effects recorded on a sound stage in sync with the picture to replace any sound that needs to be
Let me do that. Hold on. You guys are staring at that thing. Okay, let me get out of full screen. And then I have to turn on. I do this in my class sometimes. Turn on mirroring. Now you can see it. I need to get this out of the way.
Foley is live sound effects recorded on a sound stage in sync with the picture to replace any sound that needs to be replaced. The first time that I ever found out that this job existed, I just said, this is for me. You get to play in the dirt all day and come up with funny props.
The hardest part of the job for me really is the physicality.
That was perfect. Let's move on.
A big pad for the body sound, a bunch of celery for some high-end crunch, and a nice wet chamois will give me a fleshy sound.
I'm going to take some breakfast cereal, put it in here with the cornstarch.
These are gloves with paper clips. Tape them to the ends for the dog claws, and you get a good paw sound out of the glove.
The creative part of this job is using anything and everything that will work, whether it's real or not.
So, it's a nice little brief introduction. I mean, it encapsulates a lot of things, and you can see a lot of. I'll switch back to my slides here. A lot of the creativity that goes on into being a Foley artist, and so that's one sound idea. One idea for your students is to, you know, bring in things that they think might make interesting sounds, or you show them a video of something that needs sound. And tell them, you know, bring in some stuff tomorrow, and we'll record it, and we'll see if we can kind of create sounds that are believable, basically. I mean, because you saw in that video, almost everything that they were doing sound-wise wasn't the actual sound itself. I mean, the dog with the paper clips on the, it's probably one of my favorites, basically, the paper clips on the glove, right, to recreate the dog sounds, basically. And that's what these Foley artists do, and they're very good at their job. They're very imaginative, and we buy into it every time we watch one of these Hollywood films, right? We listen to it, and we're like, oh, that's a dog. Oh, that's people beating up on each other, right? Okay. You know, all those types of sound, okay? You know, so that's a fun kind of creative project, and you could talk about Foley and what he did and that kind of history. Jimmy McDonald is another good name to know. He was head of the Disney sound effects department. He invented a lot of devices. He's working in an era where they had to, you know, they didn't have the ability to go out and do location recording. So he and his colleagues actually invented a lot of these devices to make cool and interesting cartoon sounds. And you can find some documentaries in various Disney libraries. I can maybe point you to some of these if you're interested. Some of it's been documented actually on something I'll point out in a minute. But there are documentaries in kind of the Disney library where they've done little hot behind-the-scenes featurettes on various DVDs and videos and that sort of stuff about Jimmy McDonald. I mean, you could see the time period that he was working here. There's a lot of Disney classic movies that came out that feature his sound design work, basically, before the name sound design was even in existence, basically. And, oh, by the way, he was also the voice of Mickey Mouse from 47 to 77. So there's a lot of, if you see any Disney Mickey Mouse movies from that era, he was also that. But a genius in terms of finding out sounds to substitute for other sounds. Walter Murch is a good name to know. He's also a film editor. He's won Academy Awards as a film editor and as a sound person. But his credits include The Godfather, Apocalypse Now, kind of early work with Francis Ford Coppola and George Lucas on their films. And he's also written a lot on the topic of sound design. And he has a unique and interesting perspective because he's also editing the visual film at the same time that he's editing the sound effects and working on those in tandem. And actually, he's the reason he's important, he's the first person ever to be credited as a sound designer, to actually use that job title in describing his work on a film. Okay, Gary Rydstrom. Some credits that you might be familiar with, Terminator 2, Jurassic Park, the Pixar features, everything from Toy Story, to Bug's Life, to those films. I mean, you think about it, really, an animated feature and sci-fi pictures are like the two genres where sound design is crucial. Because in an animated feature, there is no sound. There is no sound you can go out and record on set, because there is no set, because it's all in the computer or in the animator's studio, that sort of thing. Sci-fi, it's this unreal world that exists out there, basically. But these are films that I'm sure your students are familiar with, whether you're showing them in class or not. But the idea that they've probably seen some of these films, and they've heard, that sound when the T-Rex lands and turns over the vehicle and all that stuff. He's got one of the guys working behind the scenes, kind of creating those sounds, making that scene intense. It's not just the CGI work; it's also the sound work that goes into those films that creates kind of the suspense and the action in those scenes. Okay, and I left off one name. Did anybody notice which name I left off? I do this with me. Ben Burtt, yes. Okay, Ben Burtt is a big, important name, probably one of the most important names in terms of modern sound design. Films such as the whole Indiana Jones quartet now, I guess we don't say trilogy anymore because there's four films, right? E.T., coming up with a voice for E.T., Willow. Wall-E is one of his more recent works. If you've seen Wall-E, actually the DVD comes with a really nice like 30-minute featurette about his sound design work. And because it's a Disney feature, he actually went back into the Jimmy McDonald archives and was pulling out some of those things and using them in the Wall-E sound design. He talks through kind of some of the devices that he found and some of the stuff he learned. And there's one little picture that I left off of his resume. Anybody know what it is? I heard it over here. Star Wars, yes, yes. So if you've got a student that's interested in Star Wars or the sounds involved in Star Wars, I mean, think about the iconic sounds from the Star Wars universe. Even if you're not a fan of the new trilogy, okay, let's go back to the original trilogy. That Darth Vader breath sound, okay, this iconic sound that just by an inhalation and exhalation, you know that something ominous is going to happen with this character, right? R2-D2 and his whole language that he speaks, Chewbacca and his whole language that he speaks. And then, of course, the iconic sound, the sound that the word off of the filming of the new trilogy is they had to stop the actors from making the lightsaber sound when they were doing the lightsaber, because everybody wanted to do the sound effect for it, basically, that lightsaber sound. There's a good YouTube clip on here. It's actually something from for some reason they didn't put it on the DVDs. It was on the Laserdisc. Someone has digitized it and placed it on YouTube for posterity, which I love. So I play this for you here to find out.
The lightsabers are one of my favorite sounds, and in fact it was the very first sound I made for the whole series. For some reason, after I read the script, even though my assignment was first to find a voice for Chewbacca and then a voice for R2, and then maybe come up with some sounds for laser guns and other things, the lightsaber fascinated me. At that time, when the script had first come out, they had some paintings that Ralph McQuarrie had done, so that there were some concepts visually of what some of these things would look like. And those pictures were very inspiring because they gave an idea of the direction we were trying to go in the look of the film. And it was inspiring to me to therefore think of sounds that might fit that kind of visual style. And I could kind of hear the sound in my head of lightsabers, even though just a painting of a lightsaber. I could really just sort of hear this sound. I think maybe somewhere in my subconscious I had seen a lightsaber before. And I went to, at that time I was still a graduate student at USC, and I was a projectionist. And we had a projection booth with some very, very old simplex projectors in them. And they had an interlock motor which connected them to the system, which when they just sat there and idled made a wonderful humming sound. It would slowly change in pitch, and it would beat against another motor. There were two motors, and they would harmonize with each other. And it was kind of that inspiration. That sound was the inspiration for the lightsaber, and I went and recorded that sound. But it wasn't quite enough. It was just a humming sound. What was missing was kind of a buzzy, sparkling sound, the scintillating element which I was looking for. And that I found one day by accident. I was carrying a microphone across the room between recording. I was recording something over here, and I walked over here with the microphone, passed by a television set, which was on the floor, which was on at the time, without the sound turned up, but the microphone passed right behind the picture tube, and as it did, this particular microphone produced an unusual hum. It picked up transmission from the television set. And a signal was induced into its sound reproducing mechanism. And that was a great buzz, actually. So I took that buzz, recorded it, and combined it with the projector motor sound. And that, the 50-50 kind of combination of those two sounds became the basic lightsaber tone, which was then, once we had established this tone of the lightsaber, of course you had to get the sense of the lightsaber moving, because characters would carry it around, they'd whip it through the air, they would, of course, thrust and slash at each other in fights. And to achieve this additional sense of movement, I played the sound over a speaker in a room, just the humming sound, the humming and buzzing combined as an endless sound, and then took another microphone and waved it around in the air next to that speaker so that it would come close to the speaker and go away, and you could whip it by. And what happens when you do that by recording with a moving microphone is you get a Doppler shift, you get a pitch shift in the sound, and therefore you can produce a very authentic facsimile of a moving sound, and therefore it gave the lightsaber a sense of movement, and it worked well on screen at that point.
So, a couple things there. I mean, what do you notice about just his vocabulary and the way he's describing sounds, and any comments on that? Yeah, there very much is an artistry to this idea of sound design and what sound design is and what is possible with sound design. But I love the vocabulary he's able to use. I mean, he's talking about the projectors harmonizing with each other and beating it. You know, he's basically hearing beat frequencies. The same thing you hear when your students are a little out of tune, right? The pulsing kind of sensation. That's what he's hearing and kind of finding a use for that, basically. But also hearing the kind of the buzzy quality. And then adding this performative element of moving the microphone around, not just leaving the microphone stationary, that sort of stuff. I think the kind of imagination that he brings to it, and certainly, I mean, in sound design world, Ben Burtt is probably, you know, like the Mozart, basically. Okay, he's it. He's like the big guy that has done the big projects with amazing imaginative sounds that he's created in these whole worlds, basically, that exist. It's very easy to get students excited about sound design, the idea of creating sounds and imagining new sounds when you start talking about kind of these great thinkers and great creators, great artists, basically, okay? And so I encourage you to hold these up as kind of ideals, basically, if you're thinking about doing these types of projects. Okay, so great sound designers. Then the next question is, you know, how do I talk like a sound designer? How do I start getting in tune with kind of the language and the lingo and those types of things? Given that I only have an hour here with you, and I've already burned through about 43 minutes of it by my clock here, basically, I can't get through all of the terminology here in just this one session. So what I'd do is I'd recommend if you go to Amazon and you type in sound design, okay, this book will pop up as kind of the number one search term. And it's actually the book I use with my students, and I read through this. I don't know that I'd recommend it for middle school and high school just because of maybe the way he talks about things in a little more of an adult way. Including I don't think it would be appropriate for middle school and high school, but it might. It's a good book. It's only like a $13 book. So if you're looking for a good quick read to kind of get acclimated to different ideas and to point you at different movies, the book was written in 2003. So the movie examples he quotes are getting a little old. There are not as many recent examples in this book, but as far as a good overview of sound design and kind of the way of thinking about sound in this way, if you're looking for something to put on your shelf to kind of get you acclimated before you do an assignment like this or a project like this, this is going to be the one I recommend. There are many other books, some that are, and it is entirely on the aesthetic and history side of thing, not technical, like this is how you use Pro Tools to do this, that sort of stuff. So it'll help you enrich your project from that end of things. Some of the books that are out there are more on the theory end of it, some of them are more on the technical, some of them are more on the historical aesthetic side. This is the one that I think kind of hits the mark, and that's the reason I use it with my students. There are more books on the way, I can tell you that. The reason I can tell you that is I've been contacted by publishers to review books because I'm teaching sound design. They want to know, hey, would you review this book, that sort of stuff. So there are publishers that are thinking in this direction because it is an area that there is more curriculum kind of being injected in that way. So what are some assignments that you can try? And you're probably already thinking about several of these, but I'll introduce just a few that I use with my students. One is just simply matching music with silent video. And I think that's the other good thing about that sound design book by Sonnenschein is it actually does encompass music and the role that music plays in film as well. So it can kind of get you thinking in that regard as well. Matching sounds with descriptions, so kind of creating kind of a vocabulary, a library of sounds for your students, and a library of words, texts, and getting them to kind of play a match and kind of discussing that matching. Because I mentioned before, so much of our language and our description of the arts, we visualize stuff. We think, we get a picture in our head. This kind of visual bias that's in our kind of the way we talk about imagination and creativity, right? Being able to build up their acoustic vocabulary, right? Their ability to describe sounds. It's a very useful exercise with your students to give them a bank of vocab words and give them a bank of just little sound files, little snippets of sound, and get them to kind of play match between those and discuss those matches, basically. Why did you pick tonal for this one versus noisy? What did you hear about it that made it sound more pitched than kind of broadband and sound and noisy sounding, okay? What is it that you hear that's more rhythmic in this sound versus arrhythmic, those types of things. And then also what I call creating sounds for video gestures. So picking up videos that have kind of obvious gestures to them, obvious movement to them, and getting your students to kind of imagine sounds. And that actually, that could work even in a musical context. Really short videos where you see something happening and they have to come up with a sound that kind of illustrates that gesture. Okay, I'm looking at the time. I have subsequent slides on each one of these three assignments. Is there a sense in the room which one you'd like to hear a little bit more about? Because I probably have time to go through one. Number two, matching sounds with descriptors. Okay, I'll jump ahead to that then. Let me get to my... I want to be conscious of the time here. Okay, so matching sound with descriptions. Okay, in that Sonnenschein book, he actually gives a chart on page 65 where he talks about the quality and then the extremes of that quality. So the sonic quality and then the two descriptors, two adjectives that you could use to describe the extremes, basically. So for rhythmic, he says rhythmic and irregular. I would say rhythmic and arrhythmic maybe might be a better choice, basically. But intensity or loudness, soft and loud, okay? Pitch, you can talk about it being low or high. For timbre, you can talk about things being tonal or noisy. For speed, you can talk about things being slow or fast. Shape, impulsive, reverberant, in terms of whether by impulsive, I mean the shape of the envelope of the sound. Are they really short kind of staccato notes, or are they really long kind of ringing, lasting notes, basically? And just the overall organization of them, whether they're ordered or chaotic. He presents them in this table. I find it a little more useful to reorganize them because some of the terms that he uses are useful for isolated sound events. Some of them are more useful for repetitive sound events. So obviously, you can't talk about how fast a single sound is, right? So if I clap my hands, okay, how fast did I clap my hands, right? I have to start doing this before we start talking about the speed of the events, right? Okay, that's what I mean versus repetitive versus isolated sound events, basically. But in an isolated sense, we can talk about frequency, and we can talk about the tonal versus noisy and the low versus high. We can talk about intensity. We can talk about whether it's overall soft and loud, and actually how it shapes, how it progresses over time, whether it's a short impulsive sound or whether it's a longer reverberant sound, okay? And then in terms of repetitive sound events, we can talk about a general kind of ordered versus chaotic, or we can talk about the speed, slow versus fast, or we can talk about things that are rhythmic versus irregular, those types of things, okay? So I find it useful to reorganize things, and I'm more of a map kind of person rather than a table kind of person. That's just me. I think more spatially, okay? But providing these key terms, and you can come up with your own even, providing them with sounds that you think match these descriptions. This is the way I do it with my students. I give them a sound file with 12 sounds in it, and I give them these 12 adjectives. I think 1, 2, 3, 4. Yeah. Because I leave out ordered and chaotic. I give them these 12 adjectives, and I say, okay, now I need you to crop and edit out each sound, and I need you to label that new sound file as, is it the low sound, low pitch, or is it the high pitch sound, or is it the fast sound rhythmically, or is it the slow sound rhythmically, that sort of thing. And it works out very well because that also teaches them the skill of going back and actually cropping sounds and editing things, and they start to get into the technical. But at the same time, I'm very keen on marrying the technical lesson with the aesthetic lesson at the same time and not separating the two. It needs to be kind of all rolled into one part of the picture. Does that give you an idea about how I do that assignment and how that might work in your classroom setting? Okay, getting them to describe sounds, getting them to kind of build up their vocabulary so they have a better way of describing sounds. That's kind of what I meant by that assignment description. Let me jump ahead here, and if we have more time, I can come back to some of my other examples and talk about them. But just to recap and summarize here, because I want to leave a little bit of time for questions, basically. So my target audience here, I'm expecting that this is for someone who's, you know, got some sort of sound setup, some sort of technology setup, and is looking for a new assignment idea, basically, and kind of interested in kind of dipping their toes into sound design. I talked about what sound design is and how it plays a role in audiovisual production, video, film, those types of things. And you don't need, you know, a big, you know, recording studio and boom microphones and all that stuff to do an assignment like this. I basically do it with a computer running Pro Tools Empowered and checking out those audio recorders to the students and getting them to download stuff off the web, basically. They put together assignments in this 101 class. And, you know, this is a 101 class, so it's freshmen, so they're only a year out of high school, so they're not that far beyond what they were, if you're a high school teacher, what they were with you, okay? Musical connections. Hopefully you see that you know, kind of being able to listen and critically describe things and analyze things and understand what's going on. You know, listening is listening, and being able to put descriptions to what you are listening is a skill that, to me, has easy transference over to musical training as well. I covered the technology needs. It's a good idea to have some portable recording equipment. I talked about some other options of adding that into your bit of I guess what you have available for your students. I talked about the materials online, the various websites, and looking for things that are licensed under Creative Commons, so you don't have to worry about sweating copyright and copyright infringement if something is labeled as Creative Commons. I talked about great sound designers, some names that you can use to get your students excited about sound design. I gave you some resources for talking the talk and learning more of the lingo, basically, and some assignment ideas that I can talk a little bit more about if we have time with questions. This recording, I was talking before, some of you came in just as I was starting. I've got ProfCast running up here, so I'm actually recording myself giving this lecture. And I'll be throwing it up on my website here in the coming days. So if you need to recap any of the material you saw, ProfCast is great because it actually takes your slides and it'll play them back in a iPod-friendly way. So you could actually be watching it on your iPod while you're running on the treadmill, listening to me give this lecture again, basically. I'll make it available under a Creative Commons license, so you're welcome to use it with yourself or pass it around or with your students. Okay. So that's my presentation. Any comments or questions about this? Yeah?
It seems like, well, based on some things you were saying, well, I guess I'll start by asking this. Do they make a Windows version of GarageBand, or is that a Mac-only program?
GarageBand is a Mac-only program, but there are a number of, I guess you'd say, analogous pieces of software that are out there that are starting to pop up. Are other people familiar with what those options are?
Mixcraft.
Yeah, I was actually doing a little bit of research on that before I did this, because I know that question always comes up anytime someone mentions GarageBand, like what's the PC alternative. If you just type in GarageBand for Windows, there's actually a guy that runs a blog that critiques these free and cheap PC software that are kind of supposed to be GarageBand equivalents on the PC side. Other questions? Yeah.
Storage.
Yes.
Video files are big, music files are big.
Yeah.
This has been a big issue for me. And I'm, again, creating this sort of common creative place for my students
mm-hmm.
within my school.
Sure.
Because the server at my school is eventually going to kick me off, I'm sure.
Yeah.
I tried using Blackboard. So what do you use for your kids to share all their work? Do you create somebody mentioned something about a .ftp site. Is there like a Google Doc site you can create?
Yeah, there's, I mean,
you can like
there's a lot of options. I mean, I guess I'm fortunate that our Blackboard sort of takes these files when I throw them. I have the students, you know, some people like to have the students hand in the digital audio workstation file and see all the different things they're working on. I'm more interested in the final product and does it work and critiquing it from that. And then let's back up and we'll talk about the techniques, basically. So I like my first take to be the final product. So I have the students bounce it. If they're using QuickTime is available, you can actually export to like iPhone format. The iPhone format is actually pretty small, to where you can get video files with sound that are, like up to a minute probably is like 10 megabytes, which is not that big a file anymore. I mean, does that sound like in the ballpark in terms of like, you can get pretty small when you use that iPhone format because.
Right. But I mean, do you have a website that you are you using?
We're using Blackboard, yeah. And we're just having this. I just have the students. Actually, what I have the students do, and this is, I guess, another thing we could talk about, you know, uses of Blackboard. I don't have them just, you know, because Blackboard lets you hand in files digitally so that the teacher can see them. What I do is I set up a discussion forum. I make the students upload them to the discussion forum, and then their follow-up assignment is to watch three other people's videos and write up a 100-word critique of each person. Yeah, it's a discussion forum, basically. So they're just responding to each other's work, and then they're critiquing each other's work. And we don't usually have time in my class to watch everybody's projects in class. So they can do that offline. They can do that at home, basically, watching each other's projects and typing up. That gets you into, you know, getting them to write about their work and actually reinforcing the vocabulary, that sort of stuff. And I find that's great. Students that would never raise their hand and offer a comment in class write really great comments for people in an online discussion forum format. It gets them kind of out of their shell. They're more comfortable in that format. So.
In the very beginning of your presentation, sure. You put up the list of the different categories of workers on a movie.
Mm-hmm.
And you said at the bottom, the sound designer is involved essentially with all those. And then you started referencing some places where they were documentaries and places where you could see that natural story.
Mm-hmm.
And then you got that bird on the Star Wars episode 3 DVD, because I'm a big Star Wars. I've watched a 90-minute documentary on the production of one 90-second slot of that.
Yeah.
And part of that documentary is a very, very extensive description and showing of people doing that work and Ben Burkin with John Williams' representative.
Yeah.
And they're all sitting in the sound studio watching the movie and they're doing the actual balancing.
Mm-hmm.
And if you have that DVD, you can watch them at work doing exactly what they're doing. And it's really quite interesting when you start talking about all this stuff. Like, I know exactly what he's talking about. I've seen them doing this on video.
Yeah, and there's these bonus features on DVDs is where you're going to find a lot of these kind of making of behind the scenes videos nowadays. Star Wars is a good example of them, but there's a number of other movies and films that have these extra featurettes about the sound work that goes into the film. Yeah.
I teach middle school. Mm-hmm. Sixth grade in general music. But I also do TV production.
Okay. Oh, yeah.
The same thing that YouTube video did on the two, you know, making the sound.
Foley.
Oh, yeah. They created him walking in the snow. They used cornstarch and rubber gloves. And that kind of thing. So for kids, it was really interesting. We also ran into the same issue with the server being too taking up too much room.
Sure.
Much, space. So what we do is we have all our music and sounds on I have it. And then when the kids want the sounds or the music or whatever, they bring their thumb disk up and they choose from mine.
Swap files, yeah.
All of their projects are on their own little thumb
mm-hmm.
drives. So we're not taking up any of the server space anymore. It's not as convenient, obviously.
Right.
But another thing that's good about it is that we've had kids from other classes, when it was on the server, we've had kids from other classes going to take sounds and move stuff around on
right.
the kids. So that was what we came up with. It's simple.
Yeah, and those thumb drives are not expensive anymore. I mean, they're about $20 to get something with like 8 gigabytes of space. So it's there's plenty of space to handle projects like this.
Yeah.
In Blackboard?
Well, no, it's
oh,
There's a site called Dropbox, yeah. Yeah. Especially, think about that discussion forum, because I've used the Dropbox before, but like I said, I don't like that it's just, it's one way. The students hand it in to me as the teacher, and I review it, and then I give them the grade back. I like that interaction between the students critiquing each other's work, because there's a lot of learning that goes on in that situation. Mm-hmm. And maybe if you approach it, of look, it's not, if, you know, maybe one way you can spin it, you know, I'm not just handing in files. I need this space so my students can see each other's work and we can extend the learning process, you know, that sort of thing. We're going to have to wrap it up here, right? So,
what is that Dropbox?
He was talking about Dropbox. Yeah. All right. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr.
Thank you very much.
I appreciate it.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, everybody.